Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?
Somewhere between science and superstition.
We have such sights to show you.
Strange Eons.
Welcome to Strange Eons Radio. Sitting directly across from me is Eric Morgan.
Hello.
He's here in person.
Nice squeak.
Sitting right next to me is Vanessa.
Hi. I'm also in person, but I'm not sick.
I'm Kelly. Well, we're hopeful that Eric is no longer sick.
Yes, he's
knock on
wood. He's tested negative.
Yeah.
And I could have told you already that he's always been negative for as long as I've known him.
Oh, my God.
Fuck everything.
Awful.
Man, I had a weird thing happen to me on the way home, kind of rushing home. Listener, we're recording this on a weekday instead of our regular Sunday, so I have a day job, and I was rushing home to get here, and as I pulled off of my off-ramp, my exit, there was a nice, newer vehicle off to the side, and a man standing by it, waving, trying to get somebody to stop, and I was just like, oh, okay. Shit. All right, so I pull over really quick. He comes walking up to the window, and he gives me the, puts his hands together, and he kind of nods to me, and he says, thank you, my friend. Thank you. I am not here for regular. I am vacation. This is not my homeland. And I said, what do you need? He said, I need gas.
Oh.
I need gasoline. And I was like, okay, do you have a can or something? And he's like, I give you my ring. And he pulled this gold ring off. And I'm looking at this and I'm like, I'm not going to take your ring. He goes, I just need the gasoline. I'm like, well, do you have a can or something? How are you going to get the gasoline? And he starts then handing me this gold chain.
Oh, my
God.
And
he's like, I give you this gold chain. I need gas to get to Canada. And
oh, my God.
At this point, I'm like, listen, I do not have time for this. I got a podcast I have to get to.
That's right.
Also, every time I've tried to be a good Samaritan, it's bit me in the ass. So I had, for whatever reason, I had a 20 on me. I never carry cash. And I said, look, man, I got $20. You know, you can have this and good luck, but I really don't have time for this. And he was like, thank you, my friend. Thank you. And then I also have Q-tips in my car, and he saw them, and he's like, may I have 3 of those?
Oh, my God.
I was like, yeah, go wild. And then and then he God bless, and I left. Now, the more I think about it, you know, I am pretty pessimistic, and I don't generally give money out to the homeless people because I know where that money is going, all of that stuff. Yeah. And I started thinking about this, and I was like, I'm sure I have been scammed, but I don't understand this scam when you've got a nice car and
he's trying to give you gold.
Well, yes, right. But who knows what this really was,
of
right?
Of course, yeah.
But on top of it, that off-ramp is, I don't know, 1 mile away from a gas station.
Oh,
and I'm like, what? Why didn't you just start hoofing it, buddy?
He probably doesn't know if he's not from here.
Well,
in his story,
he's pulled over in downtown Everett. I mean, I guess even I would have been able to go, well, somewhere around here is a gas station.
Yeah. Like a 4-lane giant inside the city road. Definitely has gas on it.
So I don't know what it all meant. I may have just given $20 to a very sophisticated drug user.
Sure.
I don't know. That sounds so weird that I feel like it's not a scam because it's just too weird.
That's how I felt but I can't explain why he wouldn't just walk to get the gas that he needed.
I can only think he was really confused and had literally no idea where he was and how the system worked. Like, I think about all the times I've been in a foreign country and I'm like, how do I get to point B?
Sesame Street?
Yeah, and people are like, oh, there's like a subway literally 2 feet from you and going, I didn't want to go in the hole in the ground because I didn't know where it would take me. Like, I can't read these
Look,
signs.
I think that is a legitimate fear.
Like, yes. There's just, you know, I wonder if you're driving around another country and I really don't know, but that's very strange.
Yeah, it's why I don't generally stop. And, you know, and the thing was, I wasn't going to say, hey, hop into my vehicle and I'll take you to get gas because I'm still pretty pessimistic about anything like that.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Very strange.
Very, very weird. I was like, does he want you to like suck gas out of your car and put it into his car?
I wasn't sure where that was going to go.
No. Why? It's not like that, guys.
You know what it was? I gave him a 20. That's my good deed.
Yeah.
We'll see. Value for value is what I say.
Okay. The value of the story, I guess, is what you right. get out of that.
Well, what except I also gave him the money. So as he was walking away, he was, reaming out his ear.
Oh, okay.
So he was choosing it immediately.
Wow. I just don't understand. That's the line I would never cross. Like, it's one thing to be on the side of the road asking somebody for help and money and gas, but to take their Q-tips is like a level of security in yourself that I do not possess.
Speaking of value for value, you guys, I was assigned a film. Micah was nice enough to throw some money our way and then asked if I would give my thoughts on a little film called Beowulf. From 1999.
That's right. I forgot that this was assigned to you.
Yeah, yeah. This was directed by Graham Baker, who directed Alien Nation, a movie I love, and The Final Conflict, another movie I love.
Mm.
The writers were a couple of guys who never really went on to anything else of note. I think one of them wrote a Masters of the Universe episode, and the other one was a producer on that really horrible Dungeons & Dragons movie.
Oh, jeez.
And that was all they've done. Mm. This movie, you guys, stars Christopher Lambert as Billy Idol.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
He's got short white hair in this, decked out all in leather. It also has Rona Mitra in. Are you familiar with her?
Mm-mm.
Very pretty, although she shares a credit with her spectacular cleavage, which is on display the entire film.
I mean, it is the story of Beowulf.
Right.
So yeah, you got to be on brand.
For this, Rona, I say thank you for your cervix.
Oh, God.
So it is based on the 8th century Saxon poem about the knight who battles an evil demon and its mother in a medieval castle. However, this movie is set in a post-apocalyptic future.
Okay. All right, connecting the dots. I think I've caught it.
I'll tell you something. It kind of actually works.
Okay.
I thought that it really would have worked with a few more bucks and better actors. but one of the things I dug up is that the producers promised a budget of $25 million.
Whoa.
But they made the film for $3.5 million, according to Christopher Lambert.
Whoa.
And the film grossed $103,000.
Ouch.
Anyway, let me tell you about this. So Billy Idol is Beowulf, and he wanders this world kind of like a Mad Max type character. So mm-hmm. this is kind of like a Mad Max feel, except there are no cars.
Okay.
But everybody's got the same costumer for sure.
Okay.
And they're in kind of this, think of what the rest of the world must look like in the Mad Max time. Like, what would London or Europe look like in their forests and stuff? If it wasn't just a desert, then you would have this kind of thing going on.
Mm.
And I was kind of digging on it.
Yeah.
There is a Grendel monster. It is a man in a rubber suit.
Beautiful.
And to try to hide that, they have this really bad video effect that kind of shimmers over him so that you can't quite see him. And that, I think they're trying to tell you that, like, your eyes cannot comprehend the evil of Grendel. It is a really bad effect, and you can see through that it is also a really bad suit. But the real problem of this movie is all they had to do was light it differently, and it probably would have been fine. This movie is lit so brightly.
Oh, no.
And the sets look really cool and everything, except they absolutely look like sets. It's like they worked really hard on them, and they were like, I am not showing every detail in this set. Because it's, I mean, you just can see everything is the problem.
Oh, weird.
Yeah. There are a lot of clunky sword fights.
Mm-hmm.
They're pretty enjoyable because Beowulf is like Batman. he has a gadget for every problem.
Oh my God.
And so it's kind of fun to watch him whip something else out that suddenly goes, and he's got a chain on it or something that takes him away. I like that a lot. He is also a world-class aerial somersaulter.
Okay. Sure. It's the feature. It's the feature.
Every fight includes at least one and as many as six aerial flips. I would normally not bring this up, but I want Micah to know that I watched the entire film. And I think not mentioning the somersaults would be a dead giveaway that I had not watched. I have one little bit of trivia on this. Christopher Lambert, Eric, he passed on the opportunity to return as Raiden in that second Mortal Kombat movie so he could be Beowulf.
Wow.
It's a real...
Honestly, it's a wash.
Yeah.
This movie is actually way better than that Mortal Kombat Annihilation movie. And I'll also say this. I don't think this is the worst version of Beowulf. I really hate that Robert Zemeckis CGI movie.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't think I ended up seeing it.
It's so hard to watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a waste of time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah, a lot of people like that. And I just couldn't get into it. This was actually kind of fun. I don't remember. I didn't look up the Rotten Tomatoes or I didn't write it down. It's probably got like a 30% or something like that.
That sounds within the realm of possibility.
That was just, you know, it's one of those kind of annoying movies that you're like, oh, almost good.
That's the hardest.
Yeah.
When you're like, if only you had just, like lit it a little different or had a different DP.
And I don't know if Micah knows this. I've probably said this before, but I had a big man crush on Christopher Lambert after Highlander and Greystoke. I just fell in love with this weirdo actor. And I think that I may have seen this when it came out, but it did not leave much of an impression. And so, Micah, thank you for bringing this back to my attention. I will not be watching it again, but I appreciate the chance to give it a rewatch.
I can tell you, I can confirm that he very much knew of your love.
Oh.
And that was exactly why he chose this for you.
Well, that's nice. So, hey, if you guys feel like throwing money our way and requesting us, or one of us, or all of us to watch a movie, it is as easy as that. Going to our website and buying us a pizza or something. Mm-hmm. Even you, Mom. Can ask us to watch a movie or a series.
Don't let my mom know that though, because that's gonna get bad. So should I mention something I saw this week?
Yes. Well, I would hope so.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I just don't know if we have room in the show after that.
We always have room for our views of the week.
So I saw a movie in the theater.
Oh.
So I went ahead and rushed my way out so I didn't get any spoilers for Thor: Love and Thunder.
Okay.
Have you guys seen it or do you plan on seeing it?
Well, I plan on seeing it.
Yeah, I'm not going to rush out to theaters though.
You don't look
It was god awful.
Wow.
I've heard bad things overall about it.
I won't say, I'm not going to do any kind of spoilers for it. What I would say is the reason for me it wasn't working is because there isn't a lot of breathing room and it's very whiplashy in tone. Mm. So you start on something very tragic and then 1 second later, you are in a huge over-the-top comedy moment. And it just never really jives. And because of the pace, you feel like things happen and no one cares. No one cares that those things are happening. Random stuff is made up that wasn't there before. And other things are forgotten within the space of the movie. So there was just a lot of things that felt like just significantly off to me. That isn't to say it doesn't have fun moments in it. There are definitely fun moments in it. There are cool things going on within it. But if I have to hear those fucking goats one more time, I will fucking murder somebody. It was just like too much. It's like five fucking times they make the same joke. Anyway, so that is the only thing I'm going to spoilery about that. It just, for me, it just was not working. I know a couple of people thought it was good, but those people also enjoy comedy. So
I was about to ask.
That is part of it, but I'm a huge fan of Taika Waititi.
Yeah.
Did you like Ragnarok?
I did.
Okay.
Yeah, I like that. I've watched, I think, all of his other movies, including Eagle versus Shark. So, like, I'm a fan of his. I just this
one didn't do it for
me. I don't think he landed this movie.
Wow. Well, yeah. I will be seeing this because watch a Thor movie for Taika. I watch it for Chris Hemsworth.
You know what? Fair.
And from what I hear,
there's a lot of Chris Hemsworth in this.
That's right.
The trailer alone shows you there's a lot of Chris Hemsworth in this movie. So.
It's being canceled in some countries because there's so much Chris Hemsworth in it.
That's ridiculous.
That's true. Because they feel it's too gay.
I've heard that, which is unbelievably dumb.
Yeah.
The moments of gay in this are not they're vastly under the amount underwhelming for actual gay culture.
I'm sure it's the usual stuff. I always forget to say his name.
Taika
said something about this is the gayest movie I've ever made or something like that. So I'm sure it's the countries that are banning it probably haven't even seen it.
Probably.
They're just going,
There's a thing in it that's very close to a plot line in the Orville show.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably the thing that they're, yeah, it's nothing though. It's literally nothing. So I would just be, you'd really have to dig in. It's definitely less gay than probably even the most recent Spider-Man movie. It's like, it's so not gay. It's like, okay, like there's that thing in the trailer where he stares at Chris Pratt for like 2 seconds, which is made way more gay in the trailer than it is in the film. And then there's like one other thing and that's it.
I completely forgot that the Guardians were also in this. Are they only in this for a brief moment or
something? They're in this as long as it takes for Taika to write them out.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Okay.
He was like, oh, I'm stuck with this. Let's see how I can get my way out of this and get to the story I want. So that's, I mean, there's a point where I was like, was Gamora in this film? Like everyone's there, but it's so brief. You're like, why did they even get your costumes out of the closet for this? This is ridiculous.
Alrighty then.
So if you wanted a Guardians movie, this is not for you.
Well, James Gunn has one coming. So you're
good. Exactly. Just wait. Hold on.
I, on the other hand, watched something. Actually, both the things I watched that I'm talking about this week, I absolutely loved.
Mm.
You were so dead on correct about RRR.
Yes!
Holy shit. That was directed by the same guy who did the Bahubali movie I talked about one time.
Oh.
Right? You know, it was way over the top. Uh-huh. Same kind of film.
Yeah.
But this one probably takes it more so.
Mm-hmm.
And, boy, you want man-on-man relationships. This movie's built on it.
That is some man love. If I've never seen such good bromance in my life.
The motorcycle and horse scenes.
Oh, my God.
This movie's fucking amazing. It is everything I wish a lot of film people would get over about. I like realism in my movies. Mm-hmm. You know, people don't talk real. It's not a good movie. Fuck that. This is the kind of movie that is fun to watch. Nothing about it is realistic, but it is so damn cool.
Yeah.
I don't care.
It like injects you with joy.
Yes.
This film just makes you feel so good. Like it is the most feel good movie I think I've ever encountered.
And the dude coming through the barrier with the animals.
Oh,
and all that stuff, like, oh my God, what the hell is going on here?
It's so funny because there's just so many spectacular moments like that too. Mm-hmm. Like that, you think you've gotten to the height of what you can see with your eyeballs, and then they're like, no, we're at the intermission. You have another hour and a half to go of even more crazy. So, yeah, I'm so glad you saw it. Did you watch it on Netflix or how did you?
Yeah, again, you're right. That would have been an amazing film. Theatrical film experience because it's big.
Yeah.
Big movie.
I mean, it would have been an incredible experience to watch with like in Indian cinema.
Oh man. Yeah.
God. like people watched the trailer and memorized, there's a dance scene in the film and they had memorized the dance, at least one of the dances, and people would get up and do the dance along with the dancers in the theater in India, which I think is so
spectacular. Was that the, at the party?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Nice.
Poor Kelly.
No, I forgot about this movie. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, definitely.
You need to.
And you should watch the Bahubali movies.
I will. You know. I will.
How about you? Another thing you've watched this week?
Something we've all watched and we probably should have discussed last week.
Uh-oh.
Was the finale of Strange New Worlds.
Oh. Yeah.
Which I enjoyed very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I will say this. So after that, I decided I had to go back and watch the original Star Trek episode, Balance of Terror, that version of.
Yeah, I need to do that. Mm-hmm.
It's not a very good episode, but it made me really dislike our new Captain Kirk. Strange New Worlds.
That's fair. He's awful.
He's getting a lot of backlash. A lot.
Well, even if they could have got his hair a little closer to what Kirk was doing at the time. He just...
Even a little lighter or blonder or something. It was really dark, I thought.
It was very dark compared to William Shatner's, but also Shatner, he filled out his suit.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say. He looks really
scrawny.
Small.
Yes.
It's not like this is 5 years before he's captaining. He's supposed to be.
He's supposed to be this Captain Kirk. Yeah. So I don't know how I feel about that. And I'm really bummed because I read that, second season, he's a regular on the show now. And I was like, I don't need to know any more about Captain Kirk, but I really love Captain Pike and this crew. And I don't think you need Kirk to bring in more viewers or anything.
It's kind of amazing because they nailed Spock. They got Spock so right.
Yeah.
Even Uhura is on, even though she's incredibly different from the end character. She feels right. It's like, wow, man, you guys missed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Sometimes, I don't know. I'm really sad to hear that he comes back because I was like, oh, it's just going to be a one-off little
flash. That's what I was hoping.
But I will say it's kind of interesting, and we're getting in spoiler territory here, but the risks they're taking as far as the people they've been getting rid of, like I'm really heartbroken about the engineer.
Oh. Yeah.
And I guess this means they can maybe get Scotty or a version of Scotty now, but I'm really sad about it.
Well, we heard somebody's voice that sounded very Scottish.
Sure did.
Just a hand. I guess they were talking, an interview with that actor, and he said they came to me with this character, and I knew from accepting the job that I don't survive the season.
That sucks. He's such a good character.
It makes sense, though, because timeline-wise and everything, you need.
Yeah.
If this is up to a timeline where Kirk should be doing Enterprise, you got a whole bunch of...
Well, except that we know that this is 10 years before Kirk takes over the Enterprise. True. So it's like, why are we 10 years of Kirk before...
Enterprise.
Yeah, it's I don't know. The other thing is, it just shocks me every time the credits come up. Akiva Goldsmith is the creator of this show, and he is sometimes one of the writers on it. And this is the guy that made that the Dark Tower movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. So
Lord.
He learned something about adaptation from that, did he?
The guy's 68 years old or something.
Oh,
he's been working in Hollywood forever, mostly on real trash.
Mm-hmm.
And so it always angers me when somebody like that does something I like because I've spent a long time hating this person for ruining other things.
Yeah.
And now I'm just like, well, you know what? The problem is I know what you're capable of, and I'm afraid you're going to do it to this show.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I do know that across the different episodes, there have been different like sci-fi writers, like book writers and stuff, and they do seem to have a pretty strong team of... My worry is that people are going to realize, oh, hey, this series is doing well, so let's get some real heavy hitters on it and put the trash people that they've had on like Picard or something onto this. That is my biggest fear. Do not ruin the show for me, CBS. I will murder you or whoever you are, Paramount.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. It's been I don't know how many years since I have watched an entire season of a Star Trek show.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want them to ruin this one.
There's been at least two episodes. I'm kind of like, well, you're going there, huh? All right. Well, we'll see. And by the end, you're like, that was great.
I dislike the penultimate episode with the storybook.
That was so silly, but fun.
I hated it.
Oh, really? It reminded me a lot of like the Next Gen episode where they do the Robin Hood. Mm-hmm. I am not a merry man. It's just like that. That is where my brain went. So I was fine. Everybody looked like they were having a ball. So that was fine with me.
Yeah. And it kind of reminded me of the stupid episodes from the original series where they would do shit like that too.
Abraham Lincoln shows up for unknown reasons.
Yeah. I was just like, I don't need this, but I'm glad you guys got something out of it.
Yeah. I've heard other people hating certain episodes that I thought were really fun. So I enjoyed the Gorn episodes.
Oh, yeah.
I did too.
Yeah.
I thought it was all. Well, speaking of watching the end of a show, something else just wrapped up, which was Ms. Marvel.
Oh, yes. Yep.
Yeah.
Finished that one.
I am behind on that one, but please discuss.
I thought they actually ended up bringing it to a really fun place in the end. I wasn't feeling it when they went overseas.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of plot getting squeezed into a very strange amount of time. I was like, and the bad guys were like nothing and really shallow. And
this huge big event is going to get wrapped up like bam.
Yeah.
Like,
I know. It was like, okay. Yeah. And also, never mind. Don't worry. Moving on. I was like, why is this even a plot point at all? Okay. So there's a few like little wishy-washy strange things going along, but I really, really loved the final episode. And I think that it brought it back to the strongest part of it, where it's very character driven and it's very, she is a good guy doing good things. She doesn't want anybody to get hurt, whether or not they are trying to hurt her. Right. And that's so beautiful and heroic and lovely. And it's fun.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It's very nice. Very nice. On a scary note on that, speaking of Marvel shows, Moon Knight, 8 Emmy nominations.
I did see that.
There's no wonder we don't pay any attention to Emmys around on this show.
I mean, Emmys, they give a zillion Emmys out. Like, yeah, I know people with like multiple Emmys, and I'm like, what? Okay. I mean, that's great.
I even reference an Emmy in my movie choice this season.
I guarantee you. I mean, did you see what the Emmys were for? None of them were for best script, acting, or directing. I guarantee you.
Yeah.
I would be surprised. It's not
their costumes or effects, something like that. Sure. The effects, really, in that one? But it might be.
They had a moment or two that looked all right.
There was some good reflection stuff going on in there.
Well,
I think they worked pretty hard on that.
Yeah, very true. On the other side of the coin, the spectacular, over-the-top, ridiculous of RRR, the absolute wonderful, grounded realism of the Hulu show series The Bear.
Somebody just recommended this to me. A client was just telling me about this.
Holy shit. It is so good. It is, what was the jewelry heist movie a little while ago with Adam Sandler that everybody was talking about?
Gem.
And stuff.
Something Gem.
Yeah.
Like, apparently whoever put this together sort of used that as an inspiration, or at least as a kickoff point. And watching the first episode, I'm going, whoa, man, this might be a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But it is so well done.
I know nothing about this. What is this show?
It is the story of a couple brothers. One owned a like a beef sandwich shop in Chicago, which is actually based on a real shop in Chicago, apparently. And the other guy became a super high level, worked in one of the best restaurants in the world, chef in New York. The guy who ran the beef shop killed himself. So his brother comes back to take over the sandwich shop. And it's basically a story of him trying to figure out how to run this shop, how to deal with the people that have worked there for like seemingly decades in some cases. And his over-the-top asshole cousin who's also worked there, but he's got to figure out how to deal with him. And a real smart woman he hires who's trying to help him do stuff better. And I've seen article after article talking people in restaurants going, it's pretty accurate to what it can be like to work in a small, high energy, especially family owned restaurant.
Ooh.
And the acting is spectacular. The story, the writing is great. There's not a there's not really a wasted character. Everybody's got a point and a reason. And even if that point is to just show up occasionally, because that's the job they have. So they're not in the front of things. So they only show up a little bit. But Dean and I watched the first episode. We're kind of like, well, maybe. And I think, I don't remember if it was Saturday or Sunday, we're like, well, let's check out another one. And it's 8 episodes. Most are about half an hour. We ended up watching all the rest of the episodes.
Wow.
And just spectacular. Like I was saying, the kind of the opposite of RRR, this one feels very real, incredibly well-written and really, really interesting. So if that subject sounds appealing or just the intensity of making shit work in a business place at all, it's like highly, highly recommended.
I didn't hear a word you said because I am so mesmerized by your new whiskey voice.
Yeah, I gotta keep this one for a while, man.
We'll just keep you a little sick all the time.
Feeling a little better. Go lick a doorknob, dude.
Right. Exactly.
Well, cool. Why don't we take a little break and then we come back and we are talking Good Doctor.
That's fine. Yes, please! For hanging that big old TV with just a little lean, you deserve a delicious Dr. Pepper.
I do?
Oh, yeah! And you're not the only one. Maybe you got the kids to school.
But I was 20 minutes late.
Oh, mama parenting is hard. And your sweet thinks you're doing great. Did you finally use that exercise bike as a place to hang your sweaters? Or did you put up a positive quote that's only missing a few letters? So sweet, unique. Baby, there's nothing better. I bet you've probably done something that deserves a doctor. Find the perfect streaming package for your brand new smart TV.
Yeah, we even saved a couple bucks.
Actually, we're losing money.
That's okay.
I just passed this test that proves I'm not a bot.
Not a bot? So hot. And if you've done almost anything, baby, then you want some something that deserves a Dr. Pepper. The one you deserve.
And we're back. Guys, this was my subgenre pick, with the idea being there's this trope in mostly genre films where there's a doctor trying to help our person out with whatever weird or supernatural thing is going on. They usually end up dying a horrible death, and I thought it was time that we saluted those people. Also, I wanted to talk about this movie, and I was trying to figure out what I could pull from it to make you guys find something halfway decent. Okay. So I could talk about this movie.
Nice.
Awesome.
So the movie that I'm talking about is from 1982 and it is called The Sender.
Do not know this one.
Nor do I.
Neither. Okay. Budget of about $1 million. Box office of about $1 million. And that comes down. There was no budget information. I was able to do the math in my trivia. So.
Okay.
Nice.
Rotten Tomatoes critics, I could find no information on that. The audience has it at 17%. and I want to throttle each and every one of those people.
Oh.
I didn't see this movie until this year when I was sick with COVID and I watched roughly 1,000 films. Mm-hmm. This was one of them, and I was just blown away by how much I loved it. It was directed by Roger Christian, who directed Battlefield Earth.
Oh.
Joseph and Mary, Prisoners of the Sun. Written by Thomas Baum, who has written a ton of television, including episodes of War of the Worlds, The Hitchhiker, Nightmare Cafe, genre stuff that we all like. Starring, I'm going to try this, Zeljko Ivanek. Zeljko. 111 credits, tons of TV in Hannibal, and you would recognize this guy if you saw him. He's that guy in a bunch of movies. So he was in Hannibal. He was in Black Hawk Down, The Bourne Legacy, and Argo. Also stars Catherine Harold. She's got 50 credits, mostly television, but she was also in the movies Nightwing, Modern Romance, and Raw Deal. Remember, these people are all going to be showing up in early 80s movies. Paul Freeman has 134 credits, like Dogs of War, Hot Fuzz, Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, but is probably best known as Balak from Raiders of the Lost Ark. And Shirley Knight, who has 178 credits. Endless Love, As Good as It Gets. And Paul Blart, Mall Cop 1 and 2.
Hey. Oh, God.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this movie is cool. It starts with this this young man. He's kind of awakened from a trance or something, and he's on the side of a road with traffic whizzing past him and everything. And he's just got a weird look on him. He looks like, let's see, Zeljko. He looks like kind of a hardened Mark Hamill, kind of that look, but like he's had a rough couple of years. So what he does is he walks across that street right to this beach, and there's a lake there. And there's people sunbathing and all that stuff. And he starts picking up these big rocks and he starts putting them in the pockets of his jacket.
Oh, no.
Slacks and everything. And he just starts walking into the lake. And people are like swimming past him and stuff like this. And he's just getting lower and lower. And finally, a couple of them notice what's going on because he hits, you know, the water up to his head. And then he just continues down. And a couple of people start running in and they grab him. He is pulled out and he is taken to a nearby mental hospital. He is then told that he has, we find out that he has retrograde amnesia, which means that you lose your, it's this thing that happens over a period of time. So you lose like immediate stuff first, but then as it goes on, you will just continue losing until you are, you know, your only memories are your earliest memories.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
It's a creepy, real thing.
Ooh.
So he's unable to remember his name or the details of his personal life, but he does think that he lives in a house within several miles there, and they ask about his parents, and he says something weird about, like, he has no father to speak of, but doesn't say anything about his mother.
Mm.
He's got no ID on him or anything like that, so they designate him John Doe number 83, and he is placed under the care of a psychiatrist, Dr. Gail Farmer. She is the good doctor in this. There are a number of doctors in this flick, but she seems to be the only one with any kind of sympathy for the patients there. So almost immediately, he makes an enemy of a fellow patient nicknamed the Messiah, who the Messiah starts screaming about how John Doe wants to behead him. And it's just a bizarre thing that he's doing. You know, or is it? So we cut then to at her home, the doctor. It's late at night. She's asleep and she hears a window being broken downstairs. So she she grabs her phone and she starts creeping down there and she's called the police and she's whispering to them. And she turns the corner and she sees this John Doe guy is in her house. He has broken a window pane on her door and reached in and unlatch the door. And so she's telling the police, there is a man in my house. I know who this man is. He has escaped from the mental facility and all this stuff. And so as she's watching, he takes a necklace from like her nightstand, steals this necklace. And then she loses sight of him, and the cops show up, of course, right after that. And no evidence of a break-in. Hmm. The window she saw broken is whole.
Hmm.
And she's telling the cops, well, he stole my necklace. And she goes to where her necklace was, and it's right there.
Ooh, creepy.
So she calls the hospital and says, can you check on John Doe number 83 for me? And the guy's like, all right. Sleeping soundly in his bed.
Ooh.
She's like, okay. She probably too quickly starts to suspect there's something more than meets the eye. I think that in the case of anybody, if you're a logical person, you don't jump to a supernatural explanation, no matter what you've seen.
Yeah.
But she pretty quickly starts to think that there's something weird going on. But she's also starting to see weird things, and it's correlating only with his sleep period.
Oh.
She will have a weird vision of something happening, and she starts putting it together. So she makes the mistake of telling her boss, who is kind of an asshole doctor, that John maybe has some form of telepathy where he sends, the sender, where he sends his dreams into the minds of other people.
Oh.
And they're able to experience this kind of semi-corporeal hallucination. It's super lifelike, and it's almost touchable. Like there's a fragility to the hallucination, but it's definitely physically there.
Hmm.
It's really, really interesting. Her boss, though, he's already angry that she seems to be getting too close to her patient. And without her knowing, he intends to start electroshock therapy on him. How do you think that's going to turn out, guys?
Really good. Okay. That's the solution.
Well,
movie over.
You guys would be very surprised with this movie. So meanwhile, Gail, the doctor, is starting to have this mysterious visitor at the hospital. She sees this older lady kind of standing around, and she starts getting suspicious of her. And every time she tries to talk to her, the lady disappears. She's unable to find her. But she does then corner her, and they have a discussion. And it seems pretty clear that this woman is John's mother.
Hmm.
And she does tell her that she must release John for everyone's well-being. And the doctor is like, hang on just a second. Do not go anywhere. And she goes to get something and she comes back. The lady's gone. Mm. So anyway, John is being wheeled in for electroshock therapy. And this is really the showcase of the film. The entire reason to watch this movie is for the scene that is coming up. He is strapped to a gurney type thing, and he's got the stuff on his head and everything, and he is not happy about this, as you can imagine. And as soon as they throw the switch, he unconsciously sends this violent and destructive hallucinations toward everyone in the hospital. Staff, patients, everyone suddenly has this horrible thing, and it is shot so cool. It's almost like Matrix bullet time, but 17 years earlier, and it's this weird, super slow motion stuff. So you can tell that this is all happening in an instant, and everybody's seeing like their worst thing. In fact, the Messiah sees John coming towards him to behead him.
Ah.
Gail, she's been thinking that he can do this anyway. So as soon as this thing hits, she kind of realizes what's going on. And she starts running down the hall to try to get to the place, to the room that they're in. My jaw is literally hanging open during this scene. I was just like, whoa, holy shit, this is amazing. She rushes in and she's able to get close enough to him because everything in the room is just exploding outward. The glass is exploding, papers are flying everywhere. And she removes the electrodes, and then suddenly everything goes back to normal. It doesn't like... didn't like drop or anything. It's suddenly not that explosion that you just saw.
Oh, wow.
That's a cool edit.
However,
no.
There is one person without a head in the hospital now.
Oh.
So, yeah. So there's stuff going on. It's this super cool shot of everyone, because all of this happened like within the course of maybe 10 seconds or something. And then it all just goes back to normal. And so everyone in the hospital is kind of like, what? did something just happen? And everything looks normal. but they are all just, you know, like completely shell shocked.
Fuck.
But her boss, who didn't believe her bullshit about his telepathy, he's like, you know what? I think you're onto something here. And he begins this intensive study of John. And meanwhile, Gale is continuing to see these other cryptic visions that he's sending, including one in which he is lying dead with his body covered in rats. So she's starting to put stuff together. She's starting to put stuff together from the woman who was talking to her and all of this stuff. And she thinks that the visions are memories of his recent past that he can't, you know, remember, repressed into his subconscious. And after John tells her that his mother used to lock him up in the house, she theorizes that his mother, who believes her son was a virgin, miraculous birth, she kept him trapped inside her house for his entire life. The guy's like 25 years old.
Oh, gosh.
And then eventually tried to kill him with carbon monoxide poisoning when she thought that he was going to leave her.
Oh.
Yeah, so we're getting into the third act here, and I really don't want to spoil it because it's got some really nice revelations and a couple of twists that I was like, oh, that's nice. That's a good one. But I will just say that his power is growing. He can't control it. And he is starting to unconsciously send visions even while he is awake now.
Ooh.
So I really, really fucking love this movie. I remember seeing the VHS cover in the 80s and I always passed by it because literally nobody ever said a word about it. It's not like they talked about it in Fangoria or anything like that. And I wish that I had been adventurous enough to pick this up and love it as a kid. Because I was just angry at myself for waiting this long to see it. Some trivia. The writer, Baum, he based his story on his own experiences growing up with an agoraphobic and overly protective mother.
Oh, good God.
Yes.
Oh, poor guy.
This one's a little complicated. The script, first purchased by 20th Century Fox, who were hoping for a quasi-follow-up to Brian De Palma's The Fury, which was a box office hit about another youth with psychic powers and everything, but production floundered and was dumped before it got off the ground. It was almost immediately picked up by Paramount Pictures, who, after Friday the 13th and My Bloody Valentine, were looking for something else to tap the lucrative slasher film market. However, director Roger Christian didn't approach The Sender as a slasher horror in the slightest, remarking that he wanted to make a film that was more Bergman than Carpenter. And I think he really did. I think this would be an A24 film now, or at least be considered quiet horror.
Wow.
Thought this was very strange. You can tell that this movie is British. Exteriors were filmed in Georgia, in the U.S.
Okay.
While interiors were filmed at Shepperton Studios in Surrey. And I was like, why was it so important for them to make it feel like it was in the States? Because you can tell it is not in the States.
Wow.
Due to Paramount Pictures' lukewarm reception toward the film's initial cut and poor test screenings, the film was only given a limited release theatrically by Paramount Pictures. It grossed $1,054,328 at the box office, less than its initial production budget. Oof. However, one of Christian's foreign agents had been touting the film, and it was selected to open for the Avoriaz Fantastic Film Festival in Avoriaz, France. Probably not around anymore, I guess.
I don't think so.
But it was well received by the audience there, and then championed by George Miller, director of Mad Max.
Wow.
That was when Paramount gave it an actual release. It was after George Miller said, come on, you guys. You're sitting on a blockbuster here.
Or not.
Can't be right all the time, George. finally, just thought this was an odd piece of trivia. This is Quentin Tarantino's favorite horror movie of 1982.
Wow.
1982. Okay.
That's well, that seems specific, but 1982, pretty banner year for horror films. So, I don't know. The Sender. I had to buy this, but I think it's very well worth buying.
Nice. Yeah, boy, your description, same thinking I'd have. I would have loved that as a teen. That was right up my horror alley as far as, damn, gotta watch this one.
Yeah, that sounds so fun. So fun. Well, I will have to try and hunt that down. Well, so at first I was really excited about this topic, Kelly. I was like, man, that sounds awesome. And so I came up with this huge spreadsheet of like all these incredible doctor films. And then I reread your message and I was like, oh, good doctor. Okay.
Oh,
okay.
Yes.
And then every film on that list got knocked off. And then I tried to Google to find my way to an answer. Because if you don't just have one, it's a really tough thing to figure. And there's 100 lists about evil doctors. And even when you specify good doctor, does not work.
I had the exact same problem. I'm like, no, I said good. It's good. In my description.
Good. Yeah, exactly. Like not evil. Good. Oh my God. It was so frustrating. And then I was trying to look up evil doctors where there's a good doctor that fights the evil doctor. And then I was like, kept finding nurses. And so this was a hard one for me. And so I don't know if my film stretches the bounds a little bit because it's kind of starring the main characters. Anyway, so I went with Killing of a Sacred Deer.
We don't have to worry about nothing. Cause we got the fire and we're burning one hell of a something. They're gonna see us from outer space.
Yeah, I'm really sorry about Bod. It's
nothing serious.
No, it is.
Like we're the stars of the human race. Human race.
Where did you two go?
When the lights started out, they don't know what they heard. Strike the match, playing loud, giving love to the world.
How did his father die?
A surgeon never kills a patient. An anesthesiologist can kill a patient, but a surgeon never can.
Don't be scared, Mom. We'll see. You won't be able to move either. But you'll get used to it.
Where is she? What did you do to her?
We're gonna let it burn.
I don't understand why I should have to pay the price. Why my children should have to pay the price.
It's the only thing I can think of as close to justice.
We can light it up, up, up. So they can put it out, out, out.
Have either of
you? Oh, my.
Yeah.
I have not seen this.
Okay.
Very curious to hear your take on this film.
Yeah. So, I've seen the poster for a long time, and it was one of those that I had been meaning to watch just for years and years. And so it was a great opportunity to go ahead and knock that out of the ballpark because it was between this and a Russian movie that the trailer did not look very good. So, all right. The Rotten Tomatoes score is 80% from critics and 63% from audience. To make sense, it is actually an A24 movie. So fills that little corner box. The budget and box office, I could not find a budget. And I have that paid version of IMDb. Did not matter. Does not have it on there. Box office was $7 million. Somewhere I read that had like it had a net positive of like $2 million. So maybe it was a $4 million picture. I have no idea. It's impossible to say. The writer and director was Yorgos Lanthimos. He is a Greek director. He's done 22 pictures, including The Lobster, The Favorite, and Dogtooth. Before that, he did a lot of music videos in Greece. The co-writer on this with him was Ephithemis Philopio, who I'm doing my best.
No, it's just, hey, I'm not making fun of
it. I was
the
just
going
to say, what are you laughing at, Margaret?
No, it's the proximity to another word that she was going for with that
there
last
name.
There
are a few names in here that are on the edge of other things. They've done 11 things. I think they work a lot with Yorgos. So Dogtooth, Lobster, but also things like Elle, Chevalier, Pity, and several short films in most recent years. Starring a lot of people that are very familiar, including Colin Farrell as Stephen Murphy. He is our good doctor. We have seen him in 64 things at some point or another. Phone Booth, Minority Report, Daredevil in Bruges, Fright Night, The Lobster, all kinds of great stuff. He was in a season of True Detective, which I did not realize. And he was in The Batman as Penguin. So which I always forget. Also co-starring with him, Nicole Kidman, as the wife of the doctor. She's been in 95 things, and like 100 of them are incredible. Mathematically, it does not work. Shut up. She broke out in Days of Thunder. She was in Far and Away, which is the first thing I saw her in. Practical Magic, Eyes Wide Shut, Moulin Rouge, The Others, Cold Mountain, Aquaman, The Northman, and recently a lot of miniseries on TV. So Big Little Lies, which is an ongoing series, but also The Undoing, Nine Perfect Strangers. And she was the first wife to escape Tom Cruise. So that's exciting. She's got that going for her. Fafri Cassidy as Kim Murphy, the daughter. She'd been in 21 things. Mr. Selfridge series was sort of where we'd probably have seen her more recently from. Tomorrowland. She was a small role in Vox Lux. And she's got 4 films coming up out of post-production. So I think she's about to be a bigger thing than she's been so far. Sonny Suljic as the son. He's been in 15 things, but I remember him from the poster of Mid-90s, where he plays the kid in Mid-90s. He was also in House with the Clock on Its Walls and Christmas Chronicles Part 2. Barry Cogan. Now, this was a breakout role for Barry. He plays Martin in this, kind of the creepy person. He's been in 37 things, but he is the guy who was in Eternals as Druig. We also saw him as Unseen Arkham Prisoner, a.k.a. the Joker in the Batman movie. He's been in Dunkirk, American Animals, and the Chernobyl TV series. Definitely very, very recognizable face, and has become pretty big in very recent years. Bill Camp is also in this as Matthew Williams, the anesthesiologist. How do you say this? The guy who makes you numb and fall asleep.
Anesthesiologist.
Thank you. Yep. I'm just going to have you say it every time. He's been in 75 things, very recognizable. He was in Birdman, Compliance, Joker, Queen's Gambit. He played the janitor. Just been in a ton of stuff. And then, weirdly, I was like, this face of this Martin's mom is very familiar. And then she turned in just the right light, and I was like, that is Alicia Silverstone. And it is. Yeah, she's been in 73 things. Started off in Aerosmith music videos, then Clueless, Batman and Robin, Blast from the Past, Excess Baggage, and has actually been working pretty much the whole time since. We just have not seen her in much. So yeah, Alicia was in it. This movie is intense. This is an intense film. Shocking. An independent A24 slow-boiled horror thriller. Weird. So we begin with Stephen Murphy, a heart surgeon, is just finishing work on a patient. He has a brief, boring conversation with his friend, an anesthesiologist.
Hey, nice.
And they talk about watches. Stephen says he's grown tired of his watch. Stephen then meets up with a young man named Martin at a local diner. You're not really clear on what their relationship is with each other. It seems like the kid really looks up to Stephen, and he gifts him with a watch that was probably the watch he was wearing a moment ago that he got bored with. He says he picked it out just for him, though, so it's hard to say for sure. But it looks like he's really taking this kid under his wing, and he pays for his food. He's trying to give him advice. He's like, oh, if you're going to start riding a motorcycle, you got to wear a helmet. He's like, okay. Everyone's talking in this really monotone, non-emotional voice all the way through. And this is the thing that is a little strange to wrap your head around when the movie begins, but by the end, it just feels normal. But I will say, like, from the get-go, you're like, why is everyone talking like they're at a table reading? So you just kind of have to sit with it. And no one's talking about necessarily anything important, and everything they are talking about is a little bit weird. So, for example, we see shortly after Martin's invited over to Stephen's home, and he's talking with his two kids, and they're talking about like puberty and growing arm hair. And the daughter's like, I just started my period. And it's just like, everyone's just saying it like very normal. And it's just very, very odd. So anyway, we also get to have a really fun sex scene that's also in that same deadpan manner where the wife aka Nicole Kidman, plays along with Steven's fetish, where she pretends that she has had anesthesia and she cannot move. And then he does stuff around her. So that's fun.
I don't like that being a fetish of an anesthesiologist.
Well, he's the surgeon.
Oh, still.
No, that doesn't help.
I'm uncomfortable with this.
Yeah. I was too. I think you're meant to be.
Yeah.
I think that's very much part of the whole thing is like, there's this strange thing about not being able to move your body throughout this film. So he shares with Anna, his wife, that Martin's father had died in a car accident 10 years before, and he actually had Martin as a patient for a short time. But it's weird because when he introduces Martin to his anesthesiologist friend, he gives him a different backstory. So Steven is constantly doing these weird little lies where he's taking information that you've seen in a previous scene and rewrapping it for the next. But it's really subtle, and it doesn't seem like he has ill intention with it. It just seems like he doesn't want to take responsibility or like face something. But since Martin's father has passed, he's been really trying to help this kid out. So as a thank you for inviting him over to his house, Martin asks Steven to come to his. He wants him to hang out with his mom, who's now raising him on his own. And while Steven is there, Martin's like, oh, let's put on my favorite movie. And Steven's like, I got to go home to my like wife and kids. He's like, no, you got to watch Groundhog's Day with us for some reason. He's like, okay, cool. And so they start watching it and he is like, oh, I'm tired. I'm going to go to bed. And so Steven, the surgeon, is left there with Alicia Silverstone, Martin's mother, and she just starts talking about how beautiful his hands are, and then she starts licking his hands, and then she tries to make out with him, and he's like, I'm going to go. Goodbye. In a very awkward Irish way. So that's strange. And things are starting to get kind of complex because Martin, by Steven inviting Martin over to his house, like his daughter has developed a crush on Martin and starts spending all her time with him. And Martin's been showing up more and more in his life in ways that Steven is uncomfortable. He's showing up at his work frequently and he's a very busy surgeon, so he can't hang out with him. And because of this strange interaction with Martin's mom, Martin just determined that they should be together. He says, you should be with my mom. I'm sure of it. I'm 100%. You've got to hook up with my mom. And I told her it's okay. And Steven's like, you know what? Let's not hang out. And so Martin starts stalking him and showing up at the car and sitting in the diner and just constantly waiting and calling and really bugging him. So Steven tries to push him away. And of course, that goes swimmingly. So shortly after this, Bob, Steven's son, wakes up and cannot feel his legs. Steven and Anna rush Bob to the hospital to try and figure out what's going on, but the doctors don't find anything wrong with him whatsoever. Steven even thinks he's faking it, but Bob promises he honestly isn't. He begins to panic more and more about what could possibly be going on with him. He's kind of dragging him around, being like, okay, stand up. And then the kid just falls over. It's just not going well. In the meantime, Martin says, hey, why don't you meet me in the cafeteria? I want to talk to you about something. And Steven's like, oh, I don't have time for this. And he's like, no, you do. So he meets up with him and Steven says, hey, so turns out you were operating on my father and you're responsible for his death. And that's why I don't have a dad anymore. And so we need to balance this out. And again, all in this very matter-of-fact tone. He says, so you have to kill one of your family members. If you do not kill one of your three family members, all of them will die. First, they'll become paralyzed. Then they will starve themselves to death. Then they will bleed from their eyes. And when they bleed from their eyes, they will only have a few hours left to live. So you'll really have to make a decision at that point. We then see the next scene. Martin is being escorted out of the hospital by security. So, but sure enough, these things are starting to come true. Bob will not eat anything. So Steven starts trying to force feed his son. He even does a spinal tap on him, tries to figure out what is going on with him, and he's just clawing up the walls. And of course, his daughter also suddenly collapses and falls ill. She can't feel her legs. Neither of the children will eat. And it's just like a ticking time bomb for his wife to lose her ability to stand. So they're doing the best that they can with it. The hospital says, look, there's literally nothing wrong with your children. We don't know what's up. You have to take them home. So they take them home and they try to care for them at home. But Steven is now so desperate that we see he kidnaps Martin and has him tied up in his basement. And he is beating the shit out of this kid.
Has he talked to like his wife and said, I've been threatened with this and it's happening?
It does happen eventually, but it's like at a really weird moment. I can't quite remember exactly when, but it takes way too long for him to tell his wife that this is going on. We do know that it does seem that Martin has some kind of control over the situation and is somehow in charge of them feeling the things they're feeling and going through the things they are, because we have a scene where he calls the daughter. They're now going out. Maybe, kind of. It's very weird. He calls the daughter in the hospital room. She's always glued to her phone. And he says, hey, come to the window and wave. And she's like, oh, I'll try. And then she just gets up and walks over to the window, waves to him, and then goes back to her bed. He leaves and she collapses. So it does seem that he has some weird control over it. And it's somewhere around then that Stephen finally tells his wife. And, you know, there's only so much she can do to, I mean, you can't do anything. This guy has got some kind of weird supernatural hold on everybody. So Steven's just like, I will just beat Martin to death and that will be fine. But that doesn't seem to work. And Martin doesn't really seem to care no matter how hard he gets hit. At one point, like a tooth comes out. He's just like, no big deal. And it's clearly not having an effect. The wife gets fed up with Steven and lets Martin go. At this point, the film gets very strange. It's already strange. But the kids and the wife all start to try and impress Steven and try to become his favorite because they don't want to be the one that's killed. And Steven has no idea who to pick. He goes to the kids' school and asks the principal which of the kids is his favorite. And he's like, which one has the best grades? And he's like, well, your son is really good at math and science, but your daughter wrote this beautiful essay. It was really incredible. So he's like, yeah, but if you had to choose one, which one would it be? He's like, you know what? I just cannot choose. And it's just, he's so desperate. It's such a black comic moment. The wife comes up to him and says, you know, I think you really should choose one of the children because we can always have another.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm not going to spoil how this movie ends. It does get very dark and very funny and very, very strange. It's insane. It's heartbreaking. It's boring. It's funny. I don't know how to describe this movie. It is not a fun watch. And I think that's because, so this entire film is based off of a Euripides play, Iphigenia in Aulis. I actually studied once upon a time in my life literature, and I took like 3 classes on Greek lit. Nice. And I will say it is a hell, definitely has Greek play vibes all the way through. The drama, the music, like there's no emotions being given by the people. And it feels like there's that kind of chorus line of explaining what's happening constantly. But then the music comes on in and tells you, oh, this is strange. Oh, this is horrible. Oh, this is sweet. The music is the one telling you what is happening emotionally through the whole thing. And everything feels so dramatic and like unfair and having to choose impossible choices in these extremes that it definitely replicates that. I didn't mind the flat talking. I will say Nicole Kidman had the hardest time with it because she got the most emotional out of everybody. She just sounded like a normal mom. Mm. And I kept being like, Nicole, bring it down a bit. I mean, she wasn't doing anything crazy, but she's like, would you like some food? I was like, ooh, you went way too high on that, man.
No.
Yeah, you're like, you gotta kill that down a little bit. The inappropriateness of what they're talking about all the time is strange. There's a lot of jerking off throughout the film, which I never super enjoy, frankly. I guess this is deep for people.
I'm a big fan of it myself, but
you know, ever since I saw it, was it Happiness or whatever? Yeah, that movie ruined it for me. I can't enjoy this in a film. I don't know. It had some really crazy scenes that were intense to watch, but fascinating. So there's a spaghetti scene that's pretty well known where he meets up with Martin before Martin goes to school at one point. And so for breakfast, Martin's having this giant bowl of spaghetti and he's like twirling it bigger and bigger and bigger around his fork. And as he eats it, the spaghetti sauce is getting like all over his face and that sort of off orangey color. It's not like globs. It's like just stains. And it's really like weird. There's a lot of odd moments of, you know, people, because they're dragging themselves everywhere. The daughter has really fucked up knees at one point. I don't know. This film is emotionally intense. I can't say it ended and I felt like, man, I'm glad I watched that. It just felt like, man, I watched that. So that's my thoughts on this movie.
You got a lot more out of that film than I did, man.
I could not stand that movie. If I wasn't paying as close attention as I was, I think I would have hated it.
I mean, because I was like, well, maybe I've missed something. I'm going to watch The Favorite because that's his big Oscar nominated one.
God.
Same shit. Same exact style of dialogue.
Yep.
Same whole bunch of people not giving a shit about anything that's going on in their life. I'm like,
yeah.
You know what? And neither do I.
Yeah. I mean, I think in some ways this is very similar to The Lobster.
I'm not even going to watch that one.
The Lobster is probably the most watchable of the movies, but it's not. It also has a lot of weird Greek feeling to it. Like, obviously, this guy is from Greece and he's using source material from around his life to inflect into this. You know, probably studied the crap out of this stuff over and over again and found interesting ways of inserting it. But I tried to watch Dogtooth and I bailed. So I don't know. I don't think this guy's for me necessarily, but that's the A24 thing. It's like some of this is like, oh my God, my life has changed. And other stuff is like, what the fuck and why? So Lamb, not for me. This, I don't know. I'm not, my life isn't worse, I guess. So trivia.
No, no.
Exactly. Fun music, at least, how they play with that. Trivia. So in the film, it is mentioned that Kim has an A+ for her essay on the play Iphigenia, which is what this whole film is based on. Colin Farrell admitted that he felt nauseous after reading the script. The heart surgery scene at the opening of the film was real. It was actually filmed. They filmed it during a real operation and of somebody who had a quadruple bypass surgery. And Colin Farrell was there in attendance for some reason.
Damn.
I don't know why, because he never once is actually in a shot of doing it. Like you see the close up of the heart surgery and then you see him as a single taking off gloves and throwing them in the trash. There's nothing more than that. So I'm like, this is a level of commitment to the role that was unnecessary. Fafhrí Cassidy is actually 10 years younger than Coogan. So Martin and then the surgeon's daughter, 10-year age difference when they were doing romantic scenes. She was 14 and he was 24 when filming. I find that gross. Design of scenes were often drawn from Edward Hopper's paintings. I don't know who that was.
Edward Hopper.
Oh, maybe that's what it was. Edward. Yes, my autocorrect even now would like to fix that for me. Alicia Silverstone and Nicole Kidman both wanted to be part of the project because they liked the director and quote unquote begged him to cast them. I don't know. I cannot say that that's necessarily true, but the whole thing was shot in Cincinnati and it premiered in Cannes, was nominated for the Palme d'Or and won Best Screenplay. It also won Sitges that year. So that's my movie.
Can I ask a spoilery question?
Sure.
Does the kid have powers?
I mean, they never tell you.
Huh. Who knows?
Question mark. He's there. And then it does. I mean, yeah, I guess once there is a conclusion that would indicate that the thing he told them was true.
Okay.
The weird part is you'd think of the three of us and my like of Tarkovsky and all these weird art wanker films that I enjoy a lot. But this one the emotional investment the actors put in is what I got out of it.
Yeah.
And they didn't put anything into it. The story, I mean, I could imagine reading that script and having a reaction like he did to reading it, because I'm sure he didn't read it like, well, this is an interesting script. I'm going to go forward with the lines and read everything like this. I'm sure he actually read it in his head.
Yeah.
Like the people going through this shit were actually going through this shit.
Yeah.
Where you're watching the movie and going, nobody here seems to give a shit about what's happening to, oh no, wait, there's a, no, I guess they sort of gave a shit for a moment.
Yep.
It just, I don't, man, I just got, there's a lot of horrible stuff. Favorite's got a lot of that too, where there's a lot of horrible stuff going on and nobody really seems to care.
Yeah.
So I'm going, okay. I'm with you.
I think that's that director's style. And I think you're right. Definitely. It is hard to be the person who cares when it is so flat. It's so flat. Mm-hmm. You have to really put a lot of yourself into it. And you don't really want to as an audience member because it's so gross and strange and intense that you don't want to be the person who's like, yeah, I'm going to forcefully insert myself into this situation that the actors are not supplying me with. It makes for a very uncomfortable watch, mm-hmm. which I think is what he loves to do.
Again, which should feed into what?
Yeah.
I mean, if somebody could, this is a real artsy movie. It's going to disturb the hell out. He's like, oh, really? Let's check it out.
Yeah.
Oh, and so I don't know. I just, it's weird.
Interesting. I'm so glad you saw it. Cause it's really great to get your take on it for sure.
Yeah, I would. Kelly, I don't think you need to necessarily put this on. Watch the trailer. And that is the movie as far as the emotional level. It's all right in that trailer.
Well, I know that for whatever reason, I was like not interested, but the story you were telling was, I was like, oh, I had no idea that it had psychic powers and all this. So.
Right. But imagine that that's all deadpan and subtle.
Right.
Yeah.
So I guess I will pass.
Yeah. I mean, by all means, if you like Greek mythology, then it might be interesting. You can kind of try to compare and contrast.
Generally, part of when you think of Greek tragedy is the horrible, gut-wrenching emotions people are going through. You know, like the mother screaming and
clawing
after her kid gets hit by the telephone pole. You know, that's like you think Greek tragedy, you think, oh my God, well, this is, the story is definitely Greek tragedy.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it.
If people had acted on the level of what is the name of that movie with the telephone pole? Hereditary. If they had acted on that level, it might have been a film on that level. But
And so, well, okay, we'll go with mine then. 1988, The Dreaming.
An island holds a dark and terrible secret.
Where you found them is the Isle of the Dead. And it's been the Isle of the Dead for thousands of years. So stop messing around with the bones of my ancestors. They're dead! And that's what you'll be if you keep meddling!
And one woman is thrust into a nightmare of her own.
I know what I saw. Look at her. There's a gash.
Is the fine line between nightmares and reality. Between myth and truth. It's all part of a twilight world called The Dreaming. It has just begun.
Anybody here is holding up?
No.
Okay.
That sounds familiar, but that doesn't mean anything.
There's an aspect of it you might like a lot or hate a lot. All depends on how you want to look at it.
Okay.
This is another one from All the Haunts BRs. After doing the same thing you did on Google, I'm like, everything I look for is giving me evil doctors.
Ugh.
I went to I've put together a list of all the movies I have that I haven't watched with notes saying, well, this is a subject matter in it. And this one had doctor next to it. So I will check it out. Oh, it's a good doctor.
I won. Yahtzee.
So I was like, I'll watch this one. It's not listed on our Rotten Tomatoes at all that I could find. So it made $2.2 million in Australia in 1988. So I don't know. It's directed by Mario Andreacchio, who's got 45 directing credits. Most of things you've never heard of because they're all Australian TV shows. The Dragon Pearl, Elephant Tales, Napoleon, and like I said, lots and lots of television. He also is the writer, wrote the same things he directed pretty much. Also writing on it was Rob George, who wrote The Battle of Jericho, Feel It, Fearless, Body Jackers. Not like your film, I don't think. And Stephanie McCarthy, who this is the only thing that she's credited as writing. Starring Arthur Dignam, who is in Moulin Rouge and Ghosts, in all capitals, Can Do It.
Okay. Ghosts Can Do It.
In case you're wondering. And the film I recently talked about, The Return of Captain Invincible.
Right.
Woot.
Penny Cook, she's the lead doctor. Young Lions and lots of Australian television. And Gary Sweet, who's in Wolf Creek TV show.
What?
Yeah, I know. I've seen the movie, but I don't know about a TV show version. Adore and Bitter and Twisted. And John Noble. It's John or Nobel, but he's Fringe, Lord of the Rings.
Oh, right.
24, The Boys. Mm-hmm. Easily recognizable. The movie opens with an incredible helicopter shot. I'm like, this is interesting because it's the very low over the water along the cliff sides of Australia, and it's moving. It's like, wow, this is just an oddly, incredibly energetic way to start out a movie. And it has no real bearing necessarily on the film, but it sure makes you stand up and go, I'm interested. The story starts with an archaeological discovery of a cave with strange art on the walls. I don't know if this is accurate to Aboriginal art in Australia, but, you know, it's on that particular box set, so there's a folk art element to it. It's a very weird-looking cave. I'm pretty sure a large portion of it was a set because, man, those are plastic-looking wet rocks. So they're digging in the side, and after a couple little knocks with a tiny little hammer, suddenly a huge cavern breaks up, and there's hundreds of skulls and human remains, skeletal remains inside this building. And the one guy reaches in and kind of touches this one bracelet, and it backflashes to American whalers, which you can't necessarily tell that, but you know, reading about it, that's why I figured they look very much like sort of Viking-esque, but not really Viking-esque. Mm. The weapons are very unique, so I'm assuming they were authentic to whaling weapons because they're really horrifying looking. Getting on the bridge, or excuse me, on the beach, and wiping out a whole bunch of local folks, and implied of worse things happening. Luckily, it doesn't really go to really horrific scenes, but it's kind of, okay, this is not a nice group of people. So they take as archaeologists will do, they take that particular piece and they bring it to a museum as the next place you see it. And breaking into the museum is a group of Aboriginal people, and they steal the one lady steals the bracelet and puts it on. And as she's running out, she's stricken with a massive illness and is taken to the hospital. Enter the doctor.
Ah.
Ooh.
So the doctor is treating her and is worried that she'd been beaten by the police.
As you do.
It's a thing. But it may be something much stranger. And this is where the movie starts to get a little bizarre and interesting. She's looking at the x-ray of the woman's head, and the x-ray suddenly starts to move, and the skull whips back and forth and around, and she's like, what is going on? And looks over at the woman on the table, and her head's doing the same thing. So it's kind of like, is this a dream? Is it real? She does end up dying. So something bad's going on. And so the doctor kind of decides, well, maybe I'll look further into this because what something very weird medically has happened, but also she continues to have these dreams, moments of weirdness popping up. So she's going to want to find out what's going on. And whalers keep popping up in dreams of hers, and she's it's hard to tell what's real and what's not for her. Her boyfriend shows up at one time and she freaks out because she's convinced he's already been killed and he's dead. It's like, how can you be coming back to life? I saw you kill. It's like, I wasn't. So I'm good. Thanks. The film at time, the acting kind of goes over the top, but that's okay. There's a lot of emotion being portrayed. But it is kind of convoluted, but it's still really interesting. It fluctuates between being a horror film and maybe an attempt to tell the terrifying treatment of Aboriginal people in Australia, but they lose that thread pretty quickly because the two characters that have any kind of moment as an Aboriginal character are killed in, like, they probably comprise in the modern times, not the flashbacks, 4 scenes. Mm-hmm. Oh. And so the woman killed at the beginning, that's understandable because it projects the story. But then there's a guy who comes in. He's like, oh, okay, he's going to carry her story forward. Oh, no, he's not. The doctor, like I said, has frequent waking nightmares. The nightmares go from being dreams to where she's actually starting to experience this as she's wandering around. So she decides she needs to go to an island where this artifact was found and figure out what's going on. She goes to the city of Innsmouth.
Oh, okay.
Weird.
It's where she...
Never heard of it.
Yeah, well, yeah. But she rents a hotel room there and then a boat to go out to the island. I think it's Kangaroo Island is the real name. And where this stuff actually did happen. For some reason, her father lives on this island.
Oh.
There's a moment or two in the story I'm going, is her father on the island or is he near the town she's visiting? I'm not entirely certain, but her dad's a dick. So, you know, it doesn't really matter. So from there, she starts to investigate further and the dreams become more intense. And the separation of reality and stuff begins to build and build. And it becomes very hard to tell what's going on. Mm. I'll tell you, I enjoyed this film.
Mm.
Even more than, was it Two Evil Eyes, I believe, is the real known one from this box. I found this one a little more entertaining than that one even. And but it's loose on the folk connection. It's like, well, we need... I almost feel like, well, we need something from Australia. Oh. Well, this has some moments.
Hmm.
Her story isn't really about solving the problems that's going on. It's more about her figuring out what's happening to her as opposed to investigating who these people were, although that's kind of the side thing of what she's doing. But with the original people being taken out, it's sort of like, you know, and then you've got this blonde-haired woman wandering around solving all the problems.
It becomes a little, bummer.
It is a fun film.
Hmm.
Enjoyable. And it does have several taglines.
Oh, no.
She uncovered a place where ancient mysteries survive and nightmares are real.
Okay.
That's from the DVD. So, yeah. I guess, you know. A psychological thriller.
Ooh.
To the point.
That's right. A place where ancient mysteries survive and nightmares are real.
Okay.
A psychological thriller. A place where ancient mysteries survive and nightmares are real.
Wow. Just mash them together. If one doesn't work, then...
A burial ground is unearthed. A girl dies. An ancient curse lives on. Are they dreams or nightmares? Nightmares or premonitions?
That's too many.
Yeah. That's...
Yeah.
They could have... That's like 3.
Yes. A side note, there have only been 5 Australian productions that have awarded an international Emmy. Told you it was going to come up. One was Captain John O, directed by the director of this film.
Huh?
Ah.
At times, it feels like Mario was determined to make a copy of The Fog.
Ooh.
It is very reminiscent of The Fog in the storyline if you've got water-based killers from the past involved in something trying to correct or be involved with nightmares that were committed. So they're showing up. Unanswered justice from the past. Slaughters crying out for retribution. It's there. There's even a scene where her boyfriend's in a rowboat and a giant boat comes right up next to him and takes out the boat he's on. A giant galleon-sized ship. That looks familiar. The director Mario replaced the film's original director, Craig, because he'd done two films back to back and was absolutely exhausted. But they decided they're going to leave over creative differences. It's like, I think you just didn't give a shit about, it's like, whatever, I'm out. It was nominated for Australian Film Institute Award for Best Achievement in Editing for Sirish Aya. It is well constructed. In the editing, is well constructed because the lines between dream and reality are muddied. It does a nice job of being a little different, especially at moments like that skull thing of the X-ray is just fantastic. The producer said the movie's originally screenplay reminded him of The Fog. In the dreaming on-camera interview with the producer, he said, I liked it immediately because it reminded me of The Fog.
Wow, jeez.
A coastal town sort of back and forth, jump between present and past. The movie's co-story, writer, director, Terry Jennings, writer, director of other things, said, I've never seen the finished film, and I'm not starting now, so I don't know how it turned out.
Oh, whoa.
So he was a little bitter about something there. The film was made on the Kangaroo Islands, which features a lot of the well-known, if you've seen movies shot in Australia, you've probably seen like Seal Bay and Admiral's Arch, because they show up a lot. Kangaroo Island does have a genuine history of being visited by whaling men who often kidnapped women and took them with them off the island. I haven't looked up yet where all this is available, but it is in the box set, which recently was on sale. So.
Oh.
Keep an eye out if you want this amazing box set for your home enjoyment.
If I remember correctly, Innsmouth is mentioned in The Fog, right? As the town of the, or Innsmouth Bay or something like that.
It's Antonio Bay, but you mean like further away?
Yeah, it's at the beginning of The Fog. She's talking about the locations and the weather and stuff.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
Interesting.
Yeah, so she's driving up to the thing and stops, looks around, turns a corner, and then you get this shot of this crooked wooden sign, Innsmouth 2 miles.
Oh gosh. Yeah, so this is a part of the all the haunts be
ours.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, well, I'll probably get to it eventually.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Well, you know, it's on the journey,
but it was nice after the last couple of films have been not great,
right,
in my selections. I'm like, man, I hope I enjoy this one. And it's not necessarily a great movie. I can see somebody watching going, what the hell is wrong with you? But I enjoyed it. It was interesting. Boy, it was definitely the end of the 80s.
Yeah. I wish you guys had mentioned that you were having such a hard time, because I could have given you hints on like what I was thinking of, because it didn't need to be a main character.
That made it harder if it is not necessarily a main character, because you just have to remember movies.
Yeah, but if you think about like movies like Species or anything like that, you've got a doctor on the team, and so then you start thinking, oh, a team movie is going to have a doctor or something like that.
True.
I was trying to actually make it easy, and I realized they didn't do that for you. Sorry.
It was more just that it's so overshadowed by bad doctor ones, and it just...
every list, every time anyone's ever going to talk about a movie that involves a doctor, they're either like, hey, if you're a doctor, you're going to love these 10 movies. Doctor Strange.
Doctor Giggles.
Yeah, seriously. Or the scariest doctor movies, top 10.
Well, I don't think we've done Mad Scientist, but we haven't done bad doctors, right? Maybe we need to do bad doctors at some point.
Let's give it a little beat. We can circle our way back.
Well, and with that then, Eric, bad doctors for your choice for coming up.
Please don't.
No. But I think we will might keep it, I don't know if necessarily legally, but in the medical field in a way. Mm. Let's do some film that features drug use or something along those lines.
Fantastic.
Doesn't necessarily have to be hard horror or something, but, you know, genre kind of ideas, but something that is either really fun if they're doing pot or, you know, something else, probably if they're doing heroin.
This sounds like something I can Google. I'm excited about that.
Man, ouch. I am excited as well. So I hope everybody at home is listening and is excited. And speaking of everybody at home, thank you guys for participating in the value for value model, for liking and sharing posts, reposting when an episode drops. We really, really appreciate it.
We've neglected our YouTube love for a little bit. Mention that because our YouTube views are starting to be more prevalent, even on the ones we're not, our faces don't appear. But Real Badger and I'll get the other guy who shows up a lot. And thank you for always, I know I'm always going to see a thumbs up from YouTube Real Badger.
Oh, nice.
Nice. Thanks, Real Badger.
Okay. Well, how about we take off, we reconvene in 1 week, and we talk about drugs.
Ew.
Sounds good.
Transportation and other considerations for Strange Eons Radio, produced by Pan Am Airlines. When you think of traveling, think of Pan Am. You can't beat the experience. Guests of Strange Eons Radio stay at Econo Lodge Everett. It's an easy stop on the road, you know what we mean. Strange Eons Radio is recorded live in front of a studio audience. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a positive review on your favorite podcast app. Sit, Ubu, sit.
No, why? It's not like that, guys.